Daniel, Chapter 11, the 13th talk in a series on Daniel, was presented by David Crabtree on July 12, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 13, Daniel, Chapter 11, accompanies this talk.
Welcome, everybody. This is Reformation Fellowship's online incarnation. We're going to look at Daniel chapter 11 this week. Okay, there was a question last week, right after I had talked, and I've got that in the notes. If you want to follow along on the notes, I encourage you to do so. If you don't want to, you don't have to. This was in the notes, and I'll just read it from the notes. Could the man dressed as a priest in Daniel be a theophany? That is, Daniel was seeing God. So that Jesus being dressed the same in Revelation signifies Jesus' glorification and his role in the kingdom. He is the Son of God with the authority of God. I think that Daniel was seeing a vision in which everything was symbolic, and what he saw was a God-like figure. And if someone had asked him what he thought this godlike figure was, I think that he would have answered it was God or something representing God. From our vantage point, I think it's possible to suspect that the figure was more precisely Jesus the Messiah. So a very fine distinction between what I'm saying and Robbie said, but I don't think that Daniel would have known that it was the Messiah. All he would have known is that it was a godlike figure. But I think in retrospect, after everything that's transpired since then, it's easier to identify that as the Messiah. Okay, we're going to be doing the last two chapters of the book. Tonight we're doing chapter 11. Next week we'll do chapter 12. And in these last two chapters, are the culmination of the book of Daniel. And one could say, yes, the last three chapters are. The last three are all the third vision of Daniel. But they're really bringing together the themes that were talked about previously and kind of tie them together. So these chapters need to be read keeping in mind everything that we have gone through in the book of Daniel up to now. Like I said, it's a continuation of the third vision of Daniel, which started in chapter 10. And in chapter 10, Daniel had been fasting and praying out of concern for the fate of Israel, because, as I understand it, they had been allowed to go back to Jerusalem, but by the time that chapter 10 happens, Daniel had probably heard that they were running into great difficulties getting Jerusalem reestablished and the temple built. And I think Daniel's wondering, so what's going to happen? There are a couple of heavenly beings, and as I talked about last week, it's complicated. It's hard to know exactly how many there are and who they are. But there are a couple of heavenly beings that are reassuring Daniel that God is listening to his prayers and that God is actively acting on their behalf, on the behalf of the people of Israel. In chapter 11, we are going to get a prediction, a prophetic prediction of what's going to happen to Daniel's people, that is, the people of Israel. Now, it's a narrow slice. It's not everything that's going to happen, but it's going to be a series of events that will happen in the second century BC of great significance for the people of Israel. And it's not good. It's a horrific scene, I think, for Daniel to see. This chapter contains straight up predictive prophecy. I mean, it's unlike what we've seen up to now. As I've noted before, the symbolism is much more heavy in the early chapters of the book, but the symbolism gradually diminishes as you proceed through the book. And now at the end of the book, there's very little symbolism. So the vision is mainly presented in just straight narrative without any symbolism to speak of at all. And it's going to make a lot of concrete, specific predictions with unique detail. So they are identifiable. The fulfillment of them is identifiable. As some of you have heard me say before, as I've looked at the prophetic books over the last few years, I have been surprised at how little detailed, specific, predictive prophecy there is. The prophecy that you read, and even the predictive prophecy that you read, is described in terms that it's really hard to tell when it's being fulfilled. There are exceptions to that. There are some predictions made that are very specific. But there isn't a lot of that. But here in this chapter of Daniel, we have a whole chapter of it, essentially. And it's very specific, very detailed, and it has come to pass, most of it. As a result, it has been there's been a lot of controversy trying to understand what's going on in the book of Daniel. And there are many who have argued that this can't be predictive prophecy because it is too detailed and too specific, and it came to pass. So it must have been written after the fact, and then written in the form of predictive prophecy. And that's a theory that goes way back. It goes back to the time of Jerome and Porphyry. Porphyry was not a believer. And he read Daniel and then described how subsequent events fulfilled the predictions in Daniel, and argued this had to have been written after these things happened. And there is about 300 years separating the time of Daniel and when these events came to pass. So that's a long time. So if someone wrote this during the time of Daniel, it is truly amazing. So ever since Jerome and Porphyry, there have been people who have argued that, and that was a debate that took place in the 4th century AD. Ever since then, there have been people that have argued that Daniel had to have been written after the 2nd century BC. Most scholars today, most scholars today would say that Daniel was written after the events. Joyce Baldwin in her commentary says, though all this is presented as if it were future, the considered opinion of most scholars is that the writer was using an accepted literary form, which would have deceived no one. The intention would be to show that the course of history was under God's direction, and so achieving his purposes. That it was all written after the fact. That's how they got them all right. But it was written in the form of predictive prophecy. But as Baldwin says, that wouldn't have fooled anybody. It was an accepted genre. They would have known what was going on. It is only the last few verses that are universally thought to be predictive, and we'll talk about that more when we get to it at the end. Baldwin says, when the history becomes prophecy, the transition can be detected because events proved him wrong. In other words, as you're going through this chapter, all of these things happen. The historical record fits very well with the predictive prophecy that you read in Daniel. until you get down to the last few verses. And then, as far as we can tell from history, those things didn't happen. And so those who think that this was written as fake prophecy, they say, well, at that point, the author tried to do real predictive prophecy, and that's why it's all wrong. So you can date this very clearly. It's after the last datable event, verifiable event, predicted in chapter 11, and before we start into the stuff that's all wrong, is the way that they would see it. I don't know when the book of Daniel was written. It could have been written by Daniel himself, or it could have been written from notes that Daniel passed on to those who were around him, and someone else who received those notes wrote it into a composition. I don't know. I don't know which of those is the case. Neither one is particularly bothersome to me. I think that it was written relatively soon after the time of Daniel, either by Daniel or someone who's taking his notes and putting it together. And I'm assuming that what we're reading in chapter 11 was truly predictive prophecy, and God got it right. The events that are described in chapter 11 is focused on, they bear directly on Israel. Like I say, this is focused on what is going to happen to Daniel's people. And it picks a slice of history that takes you from empire in general that was happening in ancient times, and it focuses down very rapidly and narrows in on those events which have a great bearing on Israel and a catastrophic event that came from those preceding events, a catastrophic event for Israel itself. What it describes is a struggle between two, at the time, world powers. These are kingdoms that developed out of the empire that Alexander the Great established. One of those kingdoms is located north of Israel in Syria, in present-day Syria, Iraq, and Iran, which was led by one of the generals under Alexander the Great. And the other kingdom is Egypt, the Ptolemaic kingdom, that was also run by a former Alexander the Great general, a Macedonian general, that was Ptolemy. So in the north, it's the Seleucids, Seleucus and his descendants, and in the south, it's Ptolemy and his descendants in Egypt. And what happens is they have conflict, ongoing conflict over a long period of time. And it just so happens that Israel is located between them. So Israel gets caught in the crossfire on numerous occasions and suffers as a result of this conflict, to which Israel is really not, they are really not participants in this conflict. They're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I'm going to go through the chapter 11, but I'm going to do it differently than I have done chapters in the past. I have broken it down into sections, so I will read a section and then I will talk about the section. But these are predicting things that happen. And so I'm not going to describe what it's predicting and then the fulfillment, because it would be too much repetition. I'm just going to read the section from chapter 11, and then I'm going to expand a little bit on what we know historically from the extra biblical record of what happened around these events that were predicted by Daniel. If you have my notes, if you're looking at my notes, what I did is in the sections of the scripture, I put in parentheses when it would say something like, he did this, I'll say who he was. I'll put his name in there. So there are a number of places where I've tried to just clarify what is being described by supplying a little bit of information that makes it much clearer what Daniel is describing. As I read the accounts, though, I will skip over those things that I put in parentheses. I'm just going to read what we find in the Bible. And as you'll see, the fulfillments fit the description that we read in Daniel very, very well, to the extent that we have the information to verify it. Daniel 11, verse 1, and this is a continuation from the end of chapter 10. In fact, let me read the last two verses of chapter 10 leading up to verse 1 of chapter 11, because it all fits together. So this is verse 20 from chapter 10. So he said, and that's the messenger, the angel messenger who's in the vision that Daniel is having and is speaking to Daniel. So he said, do you know why I've come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go, the prince of Greece will come. But first I will tell you what is written in the book of truth. And then a parenthetical statement. No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him. So this angel is continuing to speak to Daniel, as he had in chapter 10. And as I described last week, he's describing events on earth as the reflection of events that are happening in the heavenlies. And this is just a continuation of that, that if the angel that's speaking to Daniel is Gabriel, which is what most people believe, if it is Gabriel, then what he's saying is, I've been fighting against the prince of Persia, and pretty soon I'm going to have to fight against the prince of Greece. But first, I'm going to tell you what's in the book of truth, that is, in God's story of what is to happen in history. And then he goes on with his kind of informing Daniel a little bit about this conflict that's happening in the heavenlies. He says, no one supports me against them except Michael being the guardian angel or the archangel who is looking after the interests of Israel, the people of Israel. So it's just Michael and Gabriel that are carrying on this conflict with the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece. But then it says, and in the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him. So just filling in just information to help Daniel to understand what's going on and what has gone on. He's just informing Daniel that Gabriel was busy in the first year of Darius the Mede, supporting and protecting Darius, making sure that Darius was successful in conquering Babylon, solidifying his power, and doing the things that he did, including sending Jews back to Jerusalem to rebuild it. Okay, now the angel is going to tell Daniel about the events that are to come to pass in the future with respect that have a bearing on, an impact, a big impact on Israel. Verses 2 through 4. Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth, who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will appear, who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. I tell you the truth. I'm not sure exactly why he starts out that way. I assume that the idea is what I'm about to tell you is 100% reliable. That you can count on this. He says, three more kings and then a fourth. That has been problematic for people, scholars who have looked at this passage, because they say there were a lot more kings than four kings of Persia. There were 13 kings of Persia. So either Daniel is ignorant or he's just giving you a partial list. People have tried to explain this in a couple of ways. One would be to point to Proverbs and elsewhere, where it's clear that there is a Hebrew idiom where they say there are three X's, no, there are four, or and there are four, suggesting that there are several. And that shows up in certainly in poetic contexts, not infrequently. And so it has been argued that that's what's going on here. He knows there are more than four, and he's indicating that by the way that he has expressed it, but he's only interested in a few. Others say it's not his intent to enumerate all the kings of Persia. He just wants to get us down to the Greek invasion. It seems to me that's the likely answer. And why he words it three and four could be that poetic idiom. It could be that both are in play here. But if we take it to be four, and we don't count Cyrus, because it does say three more kings will appear in Persia, and Cyrus would already have been the king of Persia when Daniel was writing, because this vision occurred in the third year of Cyrus. So if that's the case, then it's the leaders after Cyrus until the events that he's going to go on to describe with respect to Greece. So Cambyses, Smerdis, Darius the First, and Xerxes the First. Those four kings all come immediately after Cyrus, and they bring us to the time of the second invasion of Greece. Under Darius the First, he tried to invade Greece. The Greeks had been problematic. The Greeks were active on the border of the western border of the Persian Empire. And they were kind of troublesome. So Darius decided to eliminate that problem forever. And he mounted a large invasion where he brought a huge army from Persia, went across the Hellespont, entered into Greece, and thought that he would be able to easily do away with this threat, because the Greeks were not a unified group. They were city-states. They fought among themselves. So it was unlikely that they were going to be able to mount a unified defense. And so Darius had a huge army, so he thought this is going to be a cakewalk. But the Greeks were able to put together a united defense, and against all odds, with a far smaller army, they were able to defeat Darius's army, and the Persians returned to Persia. Well, 10 years later, Xerxes, with a bigger army, using a lot more advanced planning, decided he was now going to take care of the Greeks, and he did the same thing again, came across the Hellespont, worked his way down into Greece, and once again, he met with stiff united defense. But Xerxes was so certain of victory that in the critical naval battle, he had his throne set up at the top of a cliff so he could oversee the bay where it was going to happen. And much to his disappointment, he saw his fleet sail into a trap, and the Greeks surrounded them and destroyed the whole navy. And as a result, once again, the Persians were forced to retreat rapidly back through Greece, back through Turkey, and back to Persia. Those two defeats of Persia by the Greeks within a period of 10 years was extremely significant in the development of Greek history, because the Greeks took this to mean that the Greeks were a lot tougher than the Persians were. They referred to the Persians as being effeminate. They knew the Persians were wealthy, but they couldn't fight. And so the Greeks, they became very proud of being Greek. It was an enormous sense of pride that developed in Greek culture, and you see it everywhere, that they have a superior culture to that of the Persians. The Persians may be richer, but the Greeks have a superior culture. That was the perspective they took. But they were never unified. I mean, they came together for a very short period of time to defeat the Persians, but then as soon as the Persians were gone, they started fighting among themselves again. So they were never a really potent military force until the Macedonians came along. The Macedonians were kind of outsiders. They're Greek, but they aren't right in the middle of Greek culture. They're kind of on the fringes. They're kind of, I think of them as the hillbillies of Greek culture. And they come down, invade Greece, and they are able to unite Greece under their control. And as a result, the Macedonians are able to put together a very potent army under Alexander the Great. But this is, 150 years later or whatever, it's quite a while later after Xerxes. But he puts together an empire, and he is that mighty king that rules with great power, described in the prophetic, predictive prophecy of Daniel. So, and Alexander decides to go east. And I think he goes east, not because he was particularly mad at Persia. It was because he thought that they are beatable. Given Greek history, the Persians are beatable, and they got a lot of money. And Alexander was dependent on mercenary forces. The thing that he needed most was money, because if he had enough money, he could keep his army going, and there's no telling what they could do. And it is absolutely amazing what they accomplished. Within 3 or 4 years, they defeated the Persians. But they just kept going east after that. And they went all the way to India. I think it took about 9 years for them to get all the way to India. But a huge expanse of territory was conquered by them and kind of controlled by them. But they got to India, and Alexander's soldiers, the Macedonians, they said, "We're tired of this. There's no end to where Alexander's going to go. We don't want to go with him all the way to the end. We've done enough. We want to go back home. We want to enjoy the plunder that we have accumulated, and we just want to go back home and live on our farms." And there were so many people, so many soldiers in his army that he counted on. They were the heart of his force, that didn't want to go on any longer, that Alexander really had no choice. So he decides, okay, we're going back. So they start back. On their way back, Alexander got sick. And I can't remember whether he died before they got back to Persia or whether it was soon after, but Alexander dies someplace in that time period. He married, and I meant to look this up, I think it was the daughter of the king of Persia at the time, who was Darius the something. I can't remember what number it was. But he was married to, and I can't remember whether it was his daughter or one of his wives. It was Roxanne. But Alexander married her. And he married her because one of the things that Alexander realized was going to be very important was for his empire to hold together, he was going to have to bring together two very disparate cultures. One is the Macedonian culture and the other is the Persian culture. And one of the things that he could do that would help that was to marry into the royalty of Persia. So that's what he did. When he died, Roxanne was pregnant, but he had no heirs. He had no offspring that were alive at the time that he died. So when he died, there was one court official, Perdiccas, who basically declared himself the administrator of the empire that Alexander had conquered. And the main generals of Alexander's army were each allowed to take a portion of the territory that had been conquered for them to rule. And I don't remember how many parts the empire was divided up into. My recollection is that it was about 10, but it may have been more than that. But the real power in the empire initially was Perdiccas. And he tried to guard his position and maintain that power and maneuvered to make it possible for him to emerge the emperor. In fact, he was apparently behind the assassination of Alexander's son when the son was born. It was soon after his son was born, Perdiccas had him killed so that Perdiccas wouldn't have him as a rival. But Perdiccas, I think before too long, Perdiccas, I believe he was assassinated, but in any case, he falls out of the picture. And there's infighting between the remaining generals, and there are four generals that emerge as the big power brokers in Alexander's empire. There is Ptolemy in Egypt, there's Seleucus in Syria, there is Antiochus in Turkey, and there's a fourth one in Greece and Macedonia, and I can't remember what his name is. So there are those four that emerge after about a 20-year struggle. There are those four that emerge as the kings with separate kingdoms within the empire that Alexander had conquered. None of them, by the way, nearly as powerful as the empire that Alexander had conquered and put together. So that's consistent with what was prophesied. Verses 5 through 6. The king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north and make an alliance. But she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days, She will be handed over together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supported her. Okay, so here's a section where keeping track of pronouns is absolutely critical in understanding what's going on, and extra biblical sources help us to keep track of those pronouns. You will notice throughout this account that there will be references to the northern king and the southern king. The northern king is Seleucus and his kingdom in Syria, Iraq, and Iran. The southern king is Ptolemy and his descendants in Egypt. And interestingly, those terms are used throughout, even though there are different kings on the throne. So we'll have Ptolemy the first, then we'll have Ptolemy the second, then we'll have Ptolemy the third, etc. But the text won't, the prophecy won't always distinguish between them. It's just the king of the south. Golden Gay says, the southern king and the northern king are generic terms to refer to the current occupants, whoever they may be, of the Ptolemaic throne in Egypt and the Seleucid throne in Syria and Babylon. Ptolemy quickly established control in Egypt, which was very significant, very important, because Egypt was probably the wealthiest area that Alexander conquered. So lots of money. And Ptolemy was attracted to that location, and that's where he established himself. Seleucus was one of the other main generals who emerged out of this conflict between the various generals after the death of Alexander. He was trying to establish his kingdom in Syria and Persia. But Antigonus, who had the area of what is now Turkey, he came out and fought against Seleucus and drove Seleucus out of his kingdom, that is, out of Seleucus's kingdom, and Seleucus fled to Egypt for safety. And he became a general under Ptolemy in Egypt for several years. But eventually, Ptolemy, with the help of Seleucus as a general, defeated Antigonus. And then Seleucus was able to return to his kingdom in Syria and Persia. And he was able then to establish his control well and even expand his empire into some of the area that had been controlled by Antigonus. Antigonus died at the Battle of Ipsus in 301 and then was eliminated from this contest. Seleucus was able to expand into Antigonus's area and develop an empire that was quite a bit larger and probably even wealthier, given that it was so big, wealthier than Ptolemy's kingdom in Egypt. After about 50 years, Ptolemy II married off his daughter Berenike to Antigonus II. And what he wanted to do was marry his daughter to the Seleucids in order to have peace between the two. He wanted that to be a tie that would bind them together in peace. In order for Antiochus II to agree to this marriage, it was stipulated by Ptolemy II that he divorce his wife, Laodike, and that there be a document written that formally precluded his sons from that marriage from ever becoming the king of the Seleucid Empire. So Berenike goes to Syria, is married to Antiochus II, but that marriage only lasts for 2 years. And after 2 years, Antiochus took back his former wife, Laodike, as his wife. And Laodike, once she was remarried to Antiochus, had Berenike killed, Berenike's son by Antiochus II killed, and all of her Egyptian attendants that had come along with her, as well as Antiochus II. She had them all killed. And Ptolemy II, that is the father of Berenike, also died at this time. Verses 7 through 10. One from her family line will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold and carry them off to Egypt. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but will retreat to his own country. His sons will prepare a war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Okay. So one from her family line, so that's one from Berenike's family line, that is her brother, who is Ptolemy III, will arise to take her place, Berenike's place. So Ptolemy III arises and is going to get revenge for Berenike. He attacks the forces of the king of the north, and those would be the forces of the then kings of that northern empire. That's Seleucus II, who was the son of Laodike and Antiochus II. So Ptolemy III attacks the son of Laodike, who is the king in the northern kingdom, and comes as far as his fortress. And it's not clear whether that's his fortress at Antioch on the Orontes or Seleucia, I guess, which was a fortified port at the time. So Ptolemy fought against first one king, one Seleucid king, and then the other, and he beat them. He was victorious against them. He also seized a number of their idols and took them back to Egypt with them. That was a common practice at the time. One way of showing complete victory is if you could carry off their idols. But then for 2 years, Ptolemy III, he didn't follow up on this victory. He left the northern kingdom alone. He went back home and basked in his glory. So then the king of the north, who at this time is Seleucus II, he invaded the realm of Ptolemy III, but was defeated and had to retreat. Then his sons, Seleucus III, first, and then after he died, Antiochus III became the kings in the northern empire. They were much more aggressive in their foreign policy than Antiochus II had been, or than Seleucus III had been. Seleucus II had been. Seleucus III, in leading the forces fighting in modern-day Turkey, he was killed. But Antiochus III picked up right where Seleucus III had left off, continued fighting in Turkey. Then he tried to take back those things that Ptolemy III had conquered that had previously been part of the Seleucid Empire. So he retook Seleucia, and he led an invasion of Judea. Judea had for a long time been controlled by the Ptolemies. This is dense history. I hope I don't lose everybody. But picking up on the main points is obviously the most important thing. Verses 11 through 13. Then the king of the south will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and slaughter many thousands, yet he will not remain triumphant. For the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years, he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. Okay, so Ptolemy IV is going to march out against the king of the north. Ptolemy, the king of the south, is going to march out with a huge army against the king of the north, who is Antiochus III, who becomes later known as Antiochus the Great because he conquered so much territory. And Antiochus the third, in order to defend himself, is going to put together a huge army. And in fact, what we learn is it's truly huge, even by ancient numbers. This is a quote from Golden Gay. He says, "In due course, Ptolemy IV sent an army to engage with Antiochus III at Raphia, the Egyptian stronghold on the border with Judea, in 217. According to Polybius, a Greek historian, who lived not too long after these events, according to Polybius, Antiochus took 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, 102 elephants into the battle against Ptolemy's 70,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants. Antiochus lost over 14,000 men in defeat. But Ptolemy, despite the encouragement, still lacked his father's instinct for war making. He was content with victory and the regaining of Judea and Phoenicia and did not press his advantage, making peace with Antiochus. The seer gives none of this exciting information. It is only by reading the verses in light of other sources that we understand more clearly what was going on. The seer is more interested in the typical nature of the event." So we learn from other historians, this was truly a huge conflict. Huge armies arrayed against each other. Ptolemy IV is victorious, but rather than following up his victory, he retreats back to Egypt, just like his predecessor had done. And Antiochus is going to rebound, and he'll be back to conquer more territory shortly. What Golden Gay says in this quote is interesting in that the author is obviously, these predictions are very selective. It's not providing a lot of historical detail that we would find interesting. It's trying to zero in on the nature of this conflict and the nature of these participants in the conflict, that is the king of the north and the king of the south, whoever that is. Over a period of 14 years, then Antiochus regroups and prepares for an even larger attack. He expands the borders of his kingdom to the east and also to the west, and he forms an alliance with King Philip V of Macedon. Then together, they attack Egypt. verses 14 through 17. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. The violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then the king of the north will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom, but his plans will not succeed or help him. Okay, so at this time, which is about 207 BC, the king of the south is going to have a lot of trouble. Antiochus III is going to invade, but before that happens, or while that is happening, there is going to be an uprising in Egypt against Ptolemy IV's rule. And it apparently is going to be an uprising that is carried out by the native Egyptians, as well as some of his soldiers and apparently some of his generals. I just point out an interesting detail here. The Ptolemies ruled over Egypt for several centuries, trying to calculate, about three or four centuries. They never did mix with the people that they ruled. There was a sharp divide between them. So it was these were foreign overlords over the people of Egypt. And an interesting fact is the Cleopatra that we all know from the story of Mark Antony and Cleopatra, which comes along a couple centuries, 2.5 centuries after the events that we're talking about here. She was the first of the Ptolemies to speak the native Egyptian language, the Demotic language. I think that's very interesting. So they really stayed separate and aloof from the people that they ruled. So it's not surprising that there would be a rebellion of the native Egyptians against the Ptolemies, and that's what happened under Ptolemy IV. Furthermore, there was a rebellion that developed in Judea at the time, which was nominally under Ptolemaic control. And those were what are called the Tobaids, party that came together around Tobias and his descendants. And this group was, they preferred the rule of the Seleucids to the rule of the Egyptians, the Ptolemies, because they got more perks from the Seleucids. So they are rebelling in Judea while this is happening. So Ptolemy IV has a lot of trouble on his hands even before Antiochus attacks. But Antiochus comes down. Well, first he conquers some of the key Egyptian outposts in the Levant, most notably Sidon, which was a heavily fortified city, very important to Egypt. Antiochus III conquered that. And even Egypt's best troops couldn't hold off Antiochus's attacking forces. So Antiochus III basically had a free hand in the Levant, and he established himself in the beautiful land. That's a reference to Judah. Then he goes down south and decides that he will make a peace treaty with Egypt rather than conquering it. But he makes a calculated choice. It's a peace treaty, which is once again firmed up by a marriage. He marries his daughter, Cleopatra the First. So this is long before the Cleopatra that we're all familiar with. He marries his daughter, Cleopatra, to Ptolemy the Fifth. And his thinking is Cleopatra will work to help him, that is Antiochus the Third, to help him eventually come to rule in Egypt as well. That having her inside the royal household will make it possible for him to take over Egypt without a military conflict. And that's what he's hoping to do. However, that isn't what comes to pass. It turns out that once Cleopatra marries Ptolemy the Fifth, he wins her over, and she is more interested in bolstering the Ptolemaic control of Egypt than she is in helping her father take control of Egypt. So what she does is to encourage Egypt to strengthen its ties with the Romans, because that's the best way of protecting themselves in the future. And that's what they did. In fact, it was Egypt's friendliness towards the Romans that kept Antiochus from invading at this point in time. It was just, the risk was too great that he would make Rome mad by doing so. Verses 18 through 20. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them. But a commander made him a vassal, will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back on him. After this, he will turn back towards the fortresses of his own country, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. So this is talking about Antiochus III, having been frustrated in his efforts in Egypt. He decides he'll expand his empire in other directions, and he decides to go westward. So he goes into what is modern-day Turkey and takes a lot of territory. He also goes across the Hellespont and attacks in Thrace, which is north of Greece, and within Greece itself. He's very ambitious, putting together a huge plot of land. But he overreaches, because the Greeks appealed to the Romans, and the Romans don't like the fact that the Seleucids, that Antiochus III, is putting together a large and powerful empire to their east. So the Romans come to the aid of the Greeks, and there are two big battles between the Romans and Antiochus III. And in both of those, Antiochus III is defeated. The first one is at Thermopylae, and the second one is at Smyrna. And after the second defeat, the Romans say, from now on, you're our vassal, and you owe us a whole bunch of money because this war was expensive. Antiochus knows, after having been defeated by the Romans in two battles, that he is not a match for the Roman forces. So he goes back home, and they take his son as hostage. That's Antiochus IV. They take him as hostage back to Rome. That's Antiochus III's, I think it's his fourth son, was taken hostage to Rome. Antiochus III now owes Rome a lot of money. And he knows that they aren't going to forgive that. He's going to have to pay it. So he goes back home. And in order to scrape together enough money to pay off the Romans, one of the things that he does is turns to one of the temples in his own empire and take a whole bunch of money that's there. And typically in these temples, they served as kind of banks. There was usually a lot of money in these temples. It was used for various purposes, but he's going to get money to pay to the Romans. That made people mad in his empire, that he would rob his own temple to pay the Romans, and he was assassinated. Antiochus III was assassinated. His successor was Seleucus IV. He was Antiochus's son. And he inherited these debts to the Romans. So he assigns the task of collecting a lot of tax money to a man by the name of Heliodorus, who goes about, starts in collecting the taxes so he can send money to Rome. But Heliodorus turned against Seleucus IV and assassinated him so that he's hoping he can take control of the empire. At that moment, Antiochus IV, who is in Rome, finds out what's going on. He races back and wants to be present in the midst of all this chaos, and he wants to make his way to the throne, maneuver his way to the throne. Verses 21 through 24. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and the Prince of the Covenant will be destroyed. After coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. Okay. Now that we start talking about the main character in this whole thing, the person towards whom this narrative has all been focused, and that's Antiochus IV. Everyone agrees that there are some subtle changes that take place in the text when we get to verse 21. There is disagreement as to what are the distinctive features of this section as opposed to what we saw before. It is argued that it becomes more typological. That is, it is less personal in its descriptions. It is more negative in its descriptions of Antiochus IV than it's been of any of the people previous to this. We see more time expressions, and we see more statements of value. And whereas there is definitely some truth into what they're saying, it seems to me the more significant break is yet to come. There will be two breaks yet to come that I think are far more significant than changes that we start to see here in verse 21. It says, he, and that's Seleucus IV, will be succeeded by a contemptible person, that's Antiochus IV. It says, who has not been given the honor of royalty. I'm not sure exactly what that means. The heir apparent for Seleucus IV was his son. Antiochus IV is the brother of Seleucus IV, but Seleucus IV's son should inherit power. Antiochus IV really doesn't have a shot at succeeding. He's too far down the line of succession. So it would have been extremely unlikely that he would inherit the throne. But Antiochus comes back and starts his maneuverings and is able to put together a party of support within the Seleucid Empire. He is also will able to win over a party within Judea, and that's the Tobiad party, and is able to put together a force that is strong enough to push the Egyptians out of Judea, which he does. Then he replaces the high priest, who is Ananias III, with someone that would be loyal to him. And that was Jason, who was the brother of Ananias. And then it's presumably from these exploits and taking over Judea that he gets the plunder and loot that it talks about him distributing to his followers. Verses 25 through 28. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his country. So Antiochus IV decides to attack Egypt, and the king of the south fights back with a big army. But there is some mutiny within his ranks, and because of that mutiny, the king of the south is not successful. What happened was there were some advisors of Ptolemy the sixth who wanted to overthrow him and replace him with his brother Ptolemy the seventh. And as a result of this treachery within his ranks, he is defeated. But he comes running to Antiochus IV and wants to form an alliance because he's afraid he's going to be overthrown and killed. So they sit down over a table and come up with a plan whereby he can be reestablished on his throne and be essentially a puppet king, ruler, for Antiochus IV. Then Antiochus, retreating from Egypt, having secured that area, comes back through Judea and establishes some of his measures in Judea of persecution against those who follow the Mosaic law within Judea. And at this time, Antiochus took a bunch of the money from the temple in Jerusalem. Verses 29 through 32. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coasts will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. So, Antiochus then later decides that he is going to invade Egypt once again. But this time when he goes down, the Romans are there. A Roman emissary is there. I've talked about this before. The Roman emissary said, "Promise me that you will leave Egypt alone." And Antiochus said, "Well, let me think about it." And the senator said, he drew a line in the sand around Antiochus, and he said, "You can't leave that circle until you tell me that you'll leave Egypt alone." And so Antiochus agreed. So he was really frustrated because once again, he was unable to establish firm control over Egypt, which he really wanted to do. So he turns back, he goes back to Judea. And while he was in Egypt, there were rumors going around in Jerusalem that Antiochus IV had been killed. So they took advantage, the pro-Egyptian element within Jerusalem took advantage of the situation and rose up against the pro-Seleucid faction within Jerusalem. And the pro-Egyptian faction won out. Antiochus is coming back from Egypt. He sees what's happened and he is furious. And so he wants to completely wipe out any pro-Egyptian faction. Now, when I say the pro-Egyptian faction, that is largely people who are keepers of the Mosaic Law, because the Ptolemies, for the most part, left the Judeans alone and didn't mess with their religious practices. The Seleucid kings, on the other hand, they wanted to establish Hellenistic culture in Jerusalem and in Judea. And so they interfered in religious practices much more heavily. So he's coming back from Egypt. He's furious. And he sides with those who are not keepers of the law. He builds a fortress it's called the Acra. It's on the southern side of the Temple Mount, overlooking the Temple Mount and the platform that the temple proper is located on, so that they could watch for any unrest that might be brewing on the Temple Mount. And that fortress would have been populated with Syrian troops. And the Syrian troops worshipped gods which were essentially Canaanite gods. That did not go over well with the people of Judea. Okay. And Antiochus IV cups the leadership in Jerusalem. He basically bribes the people that are there in control and puts his people in place and is therefore able to establish his rule to a certain extent in Judea. But he's resisted by those who are law keepers. And these is the party of the Hasidim. Hasidim is what they're called. And they emerged after the exile, people who took the law seriously. So of the people who came back from Babylon, there was a faction that took the law very seriously. And that's the Hasidim. Section 33 through 35. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. Now, scholars say, It's hard to know whether this is fulfilled in the time of Antiochus IV or not, because the predictions that we have here are of such a nature that it's just hard to determine when they have been fulfilled. They're too non-specific. They're too generic. And just in predictions in general, notice that some are very specific, very distinctive, very unique, and you can tell when they're fulfilled. Isaiah predicted that Cyrus would conquer Babylon. That is very specific, and you can tell whether that's fulfilled or not. We even have a name, so that is very specific. Other predictions are much more general. For instance, you could have a prediction, there will be trouble. How do you know when that's fulfilled? So it's that kind of statement that is really hard to say that was fulfilled by event X. And this section has more statements that are has statements that are more similar to that second kind than that first kind. Wise men are going to be persecuted. Some will be killed, some will be jailed, and some will be stripped of their wealth. That's clear. It says, a little help. Is this little help that they will receive, is that distinctive? Some say that that's the Hasmoneans. That is, that's the party that rose up against the Syrians within Judea. Are they coming to the aid of those who take the law seriously? Baldwin says, a little help is a disparaging way to refer to the support that men will attempt to give. As Porteous comments, the writer is more impressed by the action of the martyrs who proved their loyalty in the fires of persecution and contributed to the purifying of the community. So Baldwin sees this as being fulfilled in the time of Antiochus IV, and it's the Hasmoneans rising up against the Seleucids that fulfills that. But we'll come back to this. They will be joined by some who are not sincere. This could be distinctive, but we'll come back to this as well. The whole process will be purifying for the wise. So this persecution is going to purify the wise, is going to have an important impact, that the pain that they're going to feel will be productive pain. Okay, 36 through 39. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his fathers he will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the land at a price. Again, these verses lack the distinctive concrete details that we have found in the earlier section. And that's what makes it difficult to say when and how these were fulfilled. It appears the king will do as he pleases. It doesn't say the king of the north here, which is interesting. The king will do as he pleases. Presumably, it's talking about the king of the north. But from what we know, it's not clear that he fulfills these predictions. What we can say is he's successful, extremely arrogant, has a godlike self-image. He has no reverence for any gods, and the gods that are specified here is traditional gods or, what's it say, the one desired by women. And most scholars say that that is a reference to the Egyptian god Adonis, but it could be the Syrian god Tammuz. But in any case, it appears to be a god of the time. He has no reverence for these traditional gods. He will honor a god of fortresses. And what does that mean? Well, I suspect that it's talking about a powerful military and that he will pour money into that. We'll come back to that. He will be able to attack any fortress. He will honor those who recognize him. And apparently he will reward them with territory, which they will pay for. And he will set up an administration that looks suspiciously to me like a feudal order. And a feudal order is, I'll talk about it more later. Okay, so two of these are potentially distinctive, honoring a god of fortresses and establishing a feudal order. Then our last section. verses 40 through 45. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt, with the Libyans and Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. There is virtual, universal admission that what's described in these verses is not realized, fulfilled in Antiochus IV. Here we have more specific detail, distinctive detail that we could potentially link up with the fulfillment of the predictions. These are apparently events at the end of time. It says at the time of the end. Now, what's going to happen is the king of the south will attack the king of the north. The king of the north will counterattack with a huge force, including cavalry and navy. And they will sweep through and conquer many countries along the way. And Israel will be among them. But interestingly, just east of Israel, the lands of Moab, Edom, and Ammon will be spared. They will not be conquered by the force from the north, and that's modern-day Jordan. But he will conquer Egypt, Libya, and Sudan, the modern-day names of the countries that he will conquer. And he will acquire great wealth as a result of his conquests. But he's going to hear news from the north and the east that's going to scare him. And as a result, in frustration and anger at this news that he hears, he is going to annihilate many. And presumably that means many in Israel. He will set up headquarters in Jerusalem, but he will be destroyed. And no matter how powerful he thought he was, there's going to be, at this time when he's threatened, there will be no one to help him. Okay, now, in very short time, I'll try to go through my conclusion. First of all, these were remarkable predictions that were made 3 centuries before the events that they describe. That's the bulk of the chapter. There's quite a bit of detail, and they match up with the fulfillments very well. And this shows that God knows what's going to happen in history. The script is written. History happens according to how God had spelled it out from the very beginning. Why did God pick out these events and describe them the way that it was described? In just a few verses, you get a sense of lying and deceit, and there's a lot of force used whenever possible. And whenever they're successful in their scheming and their plotting, they become arrogant. And they become so arrogant that they reach the point where they believe that they can control history. But when things don't go their way and they're surprised, they become infuriated. And they all, in the end, meet their appointed fate at the appointed time. We see also that empires are hostile to one another, vying for wealth and power. So north and south are fighting among themselves almost constantly for a couple of centuries. But there is also hostility within empire. There is hostility towards God. And that doesn't always manifest itself openly and obviously, but it's always there just below the surface. And then under the right circumstances, it explodes onto the scene. And God's people are the victims of persecution, even innocent victims, even just kind of being caught in the crossfire. The account also gives you the impression of enormous continuity from one king to the next. There were 13 different rulers alluded to in this passage. And yet you don't get that sense because it keeps referring to them as the king of the north and the king of the south. Okay, so that is the way we see the predictions in verses 2 through 31. That's the story that it tells, and that's the nature of those predictions. And those came true. Two or three centuries after they were predicted, those things came true. So those predictions constitute a short-term prophecy that Daniel gave, that people living at the time that they were realized could look at and say, my goodness, this is exactly what Daniel had predicted. And that lends credence to what he predicts after that comes up at the end of the chapter. And that is something that is seen elsewhere in prophetical writings, where there'll be a short-term prophecy and a long-term prophecy. Now, in verses 33 through 35, I pointed out that there were two things that were potentially distinctive. One was they will receive a little help. And it was thought, well, maybe that is referring to the Hasmoneans. I would argue, it seems to me, that they will receive a little help could be the kind of thing that happens consistently when a group comes under persecution. That is to say, there will be some who will come to their defense, who will rally around them. And I'm suspicious that that's what this is referring to. But it will be of limited value. Don't find solace in the little help that you get from the few people that rally around you. The second potentially distinctive thing in verses 33 to 35, many who are not sincere will join them. When I was in college, just after college, I went to Russia to study in the Soviet Union. And I thought, this is going to be really fun because Christians at that time were persecuted in the Soviet Union. And I knew that. And I was thinking, I am going to be able to see a body of believers who have been purified by persecution. And therefore, they will all be people of deep faith. I was surprised when I got there to find that that was not the case, at least from my perspective, on the basis of my discernment, that is not what I found. What I found is some people with deep faith, but mixed together with those few people with deep faith, were a lot of people that were attached to the group for other reasons, that they had some psychological need or whatever. There was something that they needed excitement, whatever. That they would attach themselves to the believers, but they weren't even believers at all, I would say. So my observation was, persecution doesn't completely purify a body of believers, a whole group of believers. It just makes sure that the only ones in the group are fanatics of one kind or another. Some of them true believers, some of them there for who knows why, but other reasons. And it seems to me that that is a common phenomenon when there's persecution. So once again, I'm not sure that either this one or the previous one are distinctive prophetic predictions. In the next section, 36 through 39, I pointed out there are two that could be distinctive. One is he will honor a god of fortresses. I suspect that what's being talked about there is the emperor will place his security in, his trust in his military defenses. And it seems to me that that's common whenever you have an emperor exercising power. Any empire builder is going to put a lot of trust and stake into their military defenses. Money, injury, energy, everything. So that's not really distinctive, it seems to me. Then the last one, he will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the land at a price. I pointed out that this sounds like a feudal system. A feudal system is the definition that I learned was public power in private hands. That is to say, power that you would expect to be held by a public administration, a king and his bureaucracy. In feudalism, it isn't a king and his bureaucracy that rules, but rather it's warlords who in their realm, they're given a realm, and they exercise the duties that you expect from any administration. They exercise that the way they see fit. And they owe their allegiance to the overall head of the government, but within their realm, they rule over it the way they want, and it's their fief that's been given to them. That's a feudal system. And when I was studying Russian history, they pointed out that Russia developed a feudal system. Well, isn't that interesting? Western Europe developed a feudal system at about the same time. And there were arguments about which one borrowed from which. But other historians, especially historians of Japanese history, came along and said, well, the same thing happened in Japan. And people in other areas said, well, the same thing happened here. And so it became clear that we aren't talking about cultural borrowing. We're talking about something that happens as a default in human societies. When you have a society that devolves into chaos and order is restored by some strong man, the chances are that what will evolve will be a feudal-like system in which the strong man will say, well, you go out and rule area X however you want. You just be loyal to me. And this other guy, you go out and rule over area Y, do whatever you want, but you be loyal to me, etc. It's a quick and easy way to deal with the chaos in a large area in a very quick, short period of time. So it seems to me that what we have in these two sections are just generic descriptions of society with persecution of the godly and strong man rule, that that's what happens. It fits Antiochus IV probably, but it would fit other situations as well. So it seems to me that 33 through 39 are transitional, that in there's a sense in which it's finishing up with Antiochus and explaining what things were like under Antiochus, but it's also leading into the last part, which is not talking about Antiochus at all, but it's talking about an Antiochus-like person to come in the future. Okay, so what's it predicting in verses 40 through 45? It really is pretty straightforward, it seems to me, that if you're reading through Daniel, and especially reading through chapter 11, what comes out of it? It's at the time of the end. So I think we're talking about the end times, the time before the return of Jesus, but not long before the return of Jesus. There is going to be a final persecution of the people of Israel. And it might be particularly bad. I'm saying might be because that's not clear from the prediction itself, but given the whole context, that's my suspicion, that it will be a particularly bad persecution for the people of Israel. And it's describing a conflict between what I would guess would be modern-day Iran and modern-day Egypt. And Egypt will attack, but Iran will counterattack. It's going to sweep through the Levant, including Israel, but it will skip Jordan, and it will take northeastern Africa and become very wealthy as a result of that. But after having done that, this ruler, this strong man, is going to hear rumors of things happening in the east and the north that are going to be disturbing. And my best guess, given modern politics, is that that would be Russia and China. And apparently, they would have an interest in saying to Iran, I'm guessing, that we're going to not going to let you do that. And they're going to come and they're going to deal with the rule of Iran. He is going to establish himself in Jerusalem. He's going to carry out his frustration on the people there with heavy persecution, but he will be killed, presumably. He's going to be dealt with, and nobody will come to his aid. Notice that there are strong similarities between what happened under Antiochus IV and with this strong man at the end of chapter 11. He enjoyed great success and became arrogant. He has plans frustrated by a greater power. He carries out these frustrations on the people of God, but in the end, he is stripped of power and there's nobody who will come to help him. So I think that this strong man described in the last few verses of chapter 11 is someone for whom Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, was a precursor. There'll be a lot of similarities between the two, but this one at the end will be, I think, bigger and badder than Antiochus IV was. That's my understanding of this chapter. So I'm not going to present any more material, but I've got some questions. So I will go on to respond to those questions. Next week, I'm going to do chapter 12, and that'll be the last week in Daniel. I'm planning to go through the chapter relatively quickly and then give some concluding remarks about the book as a whole. Sam Hobbs wrote, "Why was Daniel given this vision?" I think what happens is that it is a strange vision in response to his prayers. The prayer that leads up to it is a prayer that he's praying. He's very concerned about his people and what is happening to them. And my understanding is the reason he is concerned is because 2 years earlier, just as Jeremiah had predicted, the people of Israel were allowed to return to Jerusalem to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. Fantastic. Just what Jeremiah had predicted, and it's happening. 2 years later, Daniel is looking at the situation, and the reports that he gets back from Jerusalem is there is so much opposition that the Jews who went back to rebuild Jerusalem can't get anything done, can't make any progress towards rebuilding the walls of the city and building the temple. And I think Daniel is aware of all of the lobbying that's being done by the Samaritans back in Jerusalem to prevent any progress from happening. And Daniel's thinking, I don't see how this can come about. I don't see how what Jeremiah said would happen can happen. So what's going to happen to my people? When will God be with them? And the vision, the response of the vision is, there's a lot of water that has to go under the bridge before it can be said, finally, God with them, God with us. And so I think that's what this vision is spelling out. Things are going to be really tough between the time of Daniel and the time when God is truly with them. And that's what he is preparing Daniel for, as well as the Jews in general. So it's not great news. And Daniel doesn't go away from these visions feeling good. He goes away from these visions devastated. And I think that's why. Sam asked, did Daniel have any idea how far ahead he was seeing? I think absolutely not. Not at all. I don't think he had any idea what the time span would be between the predictions that he was making and when they would be fulfilled. And Margaret says, is North America east or west of Israel? Yeah, good question. As far as I can tell, North America doesn't make it into prophecy. Now, I've looked at this stuff, and I have many unanswered questions that I still need to figure out. So I'm not really in a position to answer authoritatively on this. But as far as I can tell, North America doesn't make it into prophecy. If it does, it would be, I think, along the lines of what a number of people have suggested, that Europe is the heir to the Roman Empire, and we are kind of tag-alongs with that culturally. And that makes a certain amount of sense to me, but I'm dubious that that's the way that will play out. Just looking at the world and how things happen historically and stuff, and so I'm not speaking as much prophetically as just the way things typically happen in history. My suspicion is the United States is going to fall by the wayside. The United States will just collapse and be a non-entity when the final events play out. And what that will look like and all that sort of thing, I don't really know. But I don't see us playing into it. Maybe I'm wrong, but we'll see. Okay. Thanks for your attention. And we'll finish up Daniel, the Lord willing, finish up Daniel next week. Bye.